Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. In the first hour of our show today, we will again be talking about events over the last month or so in Israel. We're doing this program, and we'll continue to do programs in an effort to try to give you information and also give you various kinds of perspectives on these events. Earlier this week, we talked with an Israeli journalist, David Horowitz, who is editor of the Jerusalem Report news magazine, and obviously an Israeli point of view, albeit a liberal one. And we heard from some folks who said they would like, or at least that they felt that there are other points of view that needed to be represented, and we certainly agreed. So in an effort to continue this conversation, and I'm sure we will in other programs do the same, but here this morning we'll be talking about these events with Yvonne Haddad. She's professor at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. She has also served as president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America and is former editor of the Muslim World Quarterly, and has written a good deal about Islam and about political and cultural issues in the region. Also, she's written on Islamic values in the United States. She's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, people who are listening are welcome into the conversation. We certainly invite your questions and comments. All we ask of callers is that you try to be brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep our program moving along and make room for as many different people as possible as we'd like to call in. Everyone is welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And again, any point you'd like to talk with us, ask questions, make your own comments, you're certainly welcome to do that. Professor Haddad, hello.
Yes. Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I guess if people have been following the news coverage, they should be able to give the thumbnail sketch now of what has happened, beginning with the visit of Ariel Sharon, the leader of the opposition in Israel, to the place that Israelis call the Temple Mount, this highly contested site in Jerusalem, sacred both to Jews and to Muslims. He went there with a very large security contingent. He had to, because of the way people feel about him in Israel, the way Arabs feel about him. There was a predictable, angry response from Palestinians. The Israeli government responded with force, and then we saw an escalation of violence to the point now where something like, well, more than 130 people have now been killed, most of them, the vast majority of them, Palestinians. And we're now at the point where people are saying, is the peace process dead? Certainly, the relationship between the Palestinians and Israel has been damaged. No telling how it gets put back together. I wonder what your take on all of this is, and particularly on why it is that it seemed that this conflict got so bad so quickly.
Several things. One of them is that when Sharon went to the Temple Mount, he went in a very showy way. He's been to the Temple Mount before with two guards, and that would have been probably enough. He's been before many times. The thing is that according to Jewish belief, the Temple Mount is not to be rebuilt until the Messiah has come, and I don't know if Sharon believes he is the Messiah or not. But that's not the point. The point is that the presence of all that security forces with him were really just the straw that broke the camel's back, because basically the Palestinians have been very, very frustrated because the Oslo Agreement, 7 years of negotiations, looked as though it was bringing them almost nothing. That's from their perspective. And they were, I think they were really disenchanted when President Clinton, prior to the visit of Sharon, blamed Arafat for the breakdown in the negotiations. And he said that Barak has been very forthcoming, and the whole blame for the breakdown was placed on the Palestinians. The thing is that, Barak did give more than other Israeli leaders have done, but basically it is not enough because the Palestinians, in recognizing Israel as a state, gave up 80% of what used to be Palestine, and they were only asking for 20%, and of that 20%, Israel was still haggling. They wanted more and more. And from the Palestinian perspective, the peace process became a way in which Israel would take one piece of land after another so that they would be left in cages of human beings, you know, what they refer as Bantustanets, because they had no land left. And under Barak, who is considered by the American administration as this liberal guy, actually more land has been confiscated and more settlements have been built and more Israelis have been moved to the West Bank than under his predecessor, Netanyahu.
One of the I've read recently a comment by and I don't know if you know Shibli Talhami.
Yes, I do.
He's at University of Maryland, and
right.
He's also a fellow at Brookings. And
right.
And I read a comment. He was talking about what he thought mm-hmm. was going on here, and he said that he thought that the conflict here has changed in a significant way.
Absolutely.
And he said today, the conflict is much more than a nationalist conflict. It's more than a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Mm-hmm. It's certainly an Arab-Israeli conflict. But even worse, he says, mm-hmm. it might be a Jewish-Muslim conflict.
Do you think that's true? I don't think it's really Muslim-Jewish as much as Goyim. Oh, you know, Goyim being Gentile, anybody who is not a Muslim, Jewish. And the reason for that is that Israel insists on creating a Jewish state. And the only reason, for example, they insisted they can't take back the Palestinians is because they're not Jews. They made room for 1 million Russian immigrants to come in. More than one-third of them are questionable if they are Jews. And basically they have this Aliyah policy in which any Jew anywhere in the world can go and live in Israel. But the Palestinians who have been displaced or they left of their own free will, whatever way you look at it, they feel that that is their homeland, they own property there. Israel was the proposal that Barak came up with is only 100,000 would come in under family reunification, and then Israel will have absolutely no responsibility, it will wash its hands of having committed any wrong towards the Palestinian people. And this was unacceptable because there are 4 million Palestinian refugees in the world. They're the largest refugee group. They've been refugees for about 50 years now, and they were expecting that they would be able to go home and have a passport somewhere where they could become citizens of a state. Instead, they're rotting away in various refugee camps, 13 refugee camps in Lebanon, and nobody talks about their situation there. They're in Syria. They're some of the areas in the West Bank. You have some refugee camps, and in Jordan. And so the situation is really very frustrating. But it wasn't only frustrating for them. It was also frustrating for the people who are in the West Bank, whose economy was subverted basically to the Israeli economy. They cannot have water in equal amount to Jewish people. Jews pay a different set of taxes, and they get special benefits that are not extended to Christians and Muslims. So it's not only Muslim. When Israel shot at people in Nazareth and in Beit Jala, they were hitting also at Christians. It isn't, I don't agree with him that it is Muslim-Jewish. It is more of a divide between Jewish identity, Jewish state, exclusive Jewish homeland, and the presence of what the Jews call goyim. Hmm.
I think that some people on the Israeli side have mm-hmm. have said that what's happened here, the actions of Palestinians over the last few weeks, and what has been said by some elsewhere in the Arab world suggests that Arabs have not abandoned the idea of the destruction of Israel, and that Israel is still an embattled a tiny embattled nation surrounded by hostile powers and with hostile elements even within its own borders, and that the issue of the survival of Israel still continues to be an issue.
Yeah, no, I can. Yeah, you know, I've heard that quite a lot. But from the perspective of Palestinians and Arabs in the area, Israel is the superpower of the area. They've got enough army, enough air force, enough weapons to wipe out all the Arab armies put together. They have weapons of mass destruction. They've used napalm. They've demonstrated that they can take on all their neighbors and wipe them out. They have nuclear weapons. I think that there is something in the Israeli psyche that thinks, you know, that feels threatened. And I think that the Israelis have not adjusted to the idea that they can have peace with them. I mean, otherwise, one of the things that was amazing to me is to see the people from northern Nazareth attack the home of Azmi Bshara, who is a Christian Arab living in Nazareth, who is a member of the Knesset, especially when all the Arab Israeli community, Christian and Muslim, more than 90% voted for Barak. He never included them in the cabinet. They were never consulted on any of the policies. He treated them as though they were not an essential part of Israel. Whenever he talks about having a unity government, he goes to the Likud. The Arab Israelis, who are about 20% of the population, are treated as though they don't belong there. And I think we have to look at that very seriously, because I don't think that the Israelis have adjusted to the idea that non-Jews, Muslims and Christians, are full citizens of the state.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Ivan Haddad. She is a professor of Christian-Muslim relations and is also professor of the history of Islam at Georgetown University, where she is part of the staff there at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. And we're talking about the last month or so, the events that have taken place in Israel. If you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We're starting to get some callers lined up here. We'll begin with a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hi, Ms. Haddad. Are you familiar with an Islamic doctrine? It's called the House of Islam doctrine, and it says that if any land is ever controlled by Muslims, it becomes permanently Muslim, and it must never be dominated by any other religion than the Muslims. Have I gotten that right? Is that right?
I'm not aware of it. I must tell you, I'm a Christian myself, but I have a PhD in Islamic studies. There might be somebody who has said that and said that that is a doctrine, but that would be no different than some of the doctrines being used by the religious Zionists in Israel, who begin to use the Torah as, in a sense, as a deed that gives them the land forever. That once it is Jewish, it is always Jewish. Nor does that, is that very different from Israeli policies in both Israel and the occupied territories, where they talk about Judaizing territory, and it is eternally Jewish. Uh-huh. So that there is this concept, and even if the Muslims didn't have one, they would create one as a response to what they would see as Jewish provocation. I'm a historian and have studied history well enough to know that any time one group in conflict begins a doctrine that is exclusive, you have a mirror doctrine that is produced. So if there is one called House of Islam, I would definitely look to see when it was written and whether it was a response in one way or another to either the Crusades or to the establishment of the State of Israel. It would be very interesting to see when it came into being.
Well, now, you are from the Center for Muslim Christian Understanding.
Yes, sir.
And I was listening to a broadcast by a Christian minister in the Holy Land,
mm-hmm.
who was trying to understand Muslims. So he was trying to advance Muslim Christian understanding. And he asked some Muslims, this is right in Israel,
mm-hmm.
what kind of an agreement with the Jews might be satisfactory to those Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and after some discussion with these Muslims right in the Holy Land, this Christian minister finally asked them, now, look, if the Jews would agree to shrink their holdings to 1 square mile, 1 square mile of desert down by the Mediterranean, would that 1 square mile be satisfactory to you Muslims? And the Muslims in Israel said no.
Well, it depends what Muslims he was talking to, because I'm sure you could find some people in Gush Emunim or some of the other Israeli sort of fundamentalist movements who are for transfer of population, where they want to expel all the Palestinian population, who interpret, for example, the verse in the Bible, which says in the Torah, which says when you go into Amalek, when you go into the land, destroy Amalek, and they interpret that Amalek means the Palestinians and they have to be wiped out, and they are the ones who are living on the West Bank. So I would see that as parallel. I mean, there are extremists on both sides, and we're trying to talk about what would be a rational way to resolve this conflict. But, well, you know, I'm sure you can find somebody who would say that.
Well, now the Jews have been quite forthcoming. The Jewish prime minister offered Yasser Arafat a great deal more than most Jews ever conceived that it would be possible. I offered him part of Jerusalem, offered him virtually the entire West Bank, and apparently Yasser Arafat's having a hard time taking yes for an answer.
That's right. I'll tell you why. Because in international law, Jerusalem does not belong to Barak to offer. According to international law, United Nations Resolution 240, it is occupied territory, and you know, there are several other treaties that international law says that they have to negotiate. So he wasn't offering him anything that he, Arafat, and all the Palestinians and all the Arabs and all the Muslims believe belongs to the Muslims. I mean, it is a fact that 200,000 Arab Christians live in East Jerusalem, and we also know that Olmert, who is the mayor of Jerusalem, even last week, when under the greatest of tension, he quote-unquote Judaized a house within East Jerusalem, and he said, we are going to Judaize the city house by house to make sure that we have a Jewish majority. So there is a policy of dispossession, of displacement, and what the Palestinians talk about as ethnic cleansing, Israeli style, which is one house at a time, or one neighborhood at a time, or one village at a time. And so there is this feeling that Israel expropriates the land, and then it says, oh, we magnanimously will give you a little piece here or a little piece there. I don't think that any, you know, Arafat is reported to have said the Muslim who will sign away Jerusalem has not been born. I don't think that he is wrong. I don't think there is any Muslim who would have agreed to Barak's, what is considered a magnanimous offer. Because I don't think you know that prior to 48, most of Western Jerusalem was Arab. It was owned, you know, a large part of it was owned by Arab Christians. And that was all conceded. They didn't ask for a return to West Jerusalem. They said, you can keep that part of it. I know it is a contentious issue. I know it is a religious issue. But I think that the American press sort of looked at this act as a magnanimous act. The Arabs thought it wasn't even a starting point.
Let me just quickly ask a question, and then I have other callers, and I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on. The United States has represented itself as being an honest broker, or at least, and some parties would say that was the attempt that had been made. And I wonder whether you think about the positions the United States has taken and the things that the administration has said, whether in fact it has been.
I don't think that any of the Arab you know, material that I've been reading on the internet and watching Arab television and reading newspapers, I don't think anybody would look at the United States as being an honest broker. The reason is that the people who are in charge of running the peace process came out of the Israeli lobby. Whether you look at Dennis Ross, who's been in charge, or Martin Indyk, who came out of the Israeli lobby, and you know, in November he wasn't even a citizen, and he came out of being Israeli lobby, and now he's ambassador to Israel. And the question is, how many Arabs are there sort of looking at this thing? Did they discuss it with any Arabs? There are, if you have 27 people that came out of the Israeli lobby running for American foreign policy in the Middle East, you don't have 27 Chinese running American foreign policy towards China, or 27 Japanese, or 27 Germans. And so it's a very unusual situation, and increasingly you see that the Arab press is pointing to that fact and saying that the people who are running this peace process are committed to the Israeli perspective, and they are using American power, American unilateral global power, and saying we will enforce this. And they can point to the fact that the Congress just yesterday or the day before voted in majority to support the contention that Israel is the victim, whereas the whole United Nations, the whole world, voted that it was the Palestinians who were the victims. So that it is perceived as one-sided pro-Israeli. And then you have the issue, you know, just yesterday, in which even Muslims and Arabs who have contributed to Mrs. Clinton's campaign and Bush's campaign, and their money is being returned, which is seen as being an act which is disenfranchising them. So that there is a great deal of questioning about the honest broker thing.
We're already at our midpoint. We have other callers I promise we'll get right to. I just would like to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Ivan Haddad. She's professor of Christian-Muslim Relations at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Urbana, and this would be line one.
Hello? Yes.
Yes.
I had always held the belief that that moderate and reasonable people on both sides of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict could come to some resolution. I really had faith in the peace process, but
I did too.
But then I had there were recent events and an article that appeared by George Will, who's actually an Urbana native.
Mm-hmm.
And George Will said that in 1936, when Hitler said he was going to kill the Jews, nobody believed it because they all dismissed it, and then he did. But then he said in streets in Jordan and in many Arab countries, and many Palestinians are saying kill the Jews, and maybe we should believe it this time.
Mm-hmm.
When are we going to? Maybe we should take it seriously. Mm-hmm. Maybe that is what. Maybe that is a stronger sentiment among Arab and Muslim populations than we had realized. What do you think of that?
Well, I read George Will. I like a lot of what he says, but I do know that he's very anti-Arab, anti-Muslim. We have a file on him we call him Islamophobe or Arabophobe. So I don't doubt that some Muslims are saying kill the Jews, but have you also seen the fact that there are Jewish people running all over the West Bank calling kill the Arabs? And the issue is, shall we believe them? And if we don't believe them, we have a record. When Sharon went into Lebanon, 20,000 people died in Lebanon under the code name Shalom Galilee. The word shalom begins to mean to Arabs. Every time the Israelis say shalom, they think, you know, more people are going to be killed. So I think that the hatred among people, those who are saying kill the Jews and those who are saying kill the Muslims, is there. There's no question that it is on both sides. And I really think that, that the leadership must step in and do something. And If you look at some of the writings of the initial Zionists, I mean, even the book about the Jewish state, the first book of Jewish Zionism, it says that we're going to go into the land and spirit, we're going to throw them out into the desert. Basically, from the beginning, it was conceived as an exclusive Jewish state, and the only reason that they're having problems is the fact that the Palestinians are Christian and Muslim. If they were Jews, they would be welcomed into the state of Israel.
Yeah, but if Israel was a Jewish state, how come there are so many Arabs, Israeli Arabs?
They haven't finished kicking them out because they were there before.
In other words,
population came from overseas.
Do you think they've taken steps to kick them out? I don't see those.
They did in 47. We have in the diaries of Rabin, he participated in kicking them out in 67. They were lined up, people from Ramleh, from Safat, and they were dragged. We have diaries of Israeli soldiers in which they were told, get going. And some of them were beaten and because they refused to cede their land. And this is all part of the documentation that you have in revisionist history by people like Benny Morris and some of the other Israeli historians that are writing. They were kicked out. You have the massacre at Deir Yassin, in which women and children and old men were killed, and then the Israelis went in with loudspeakers on buses, and they had screams that were taped, and they would go from village to village, and they would say the same thing: "We'll hit you if you don't run away." And people ran away.
I think that clearly that there initially. You know, in 1947 or 8, that there were Palestinian people that were pushed out during the course of a war.
Right.
But after all, Israel is a state that in its parliament has Muslim Palestinian members in its parliament.
Right.
So it doesn't seem like it's. Well, I don't want to pursue this.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I don't know if you heard what we were talking about before.
I did. I listened to the whole program.
You know, they helped elect this government, and they have absolutely no say in any other policy. They're totally ignored by the Israeli administration. If they want a unity government, why don't they have one of the six members? You know, there are six members of parliament that are Arabs. Muslim and Christian. Why don't they have one of them in the cabinet? Why don't they consult with them? After all, you know, over 90% voted for Barak and the Labor Party.
Okay, I don't want to...
Okay.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I thank you for calling. It seems that one of the great challenges that both Mr. Barak and Mr. Arafat face is that on both sides there are individuals who take the extreme point of view and seem not interested in negotiating or coexistence. And after all, we only have to look back two prime ministers in Israel to see one was assassinated, and he wasn't assassinated by an Arab.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certain that also on the Palestinian side there are probably people who would not shed a tear if something happened to Yasser Arafat.
Oh, there are quite a few.
I'm confident.
I'll be honest with you. He is seen by many as being the enforcer as he proceeded with the Oslo Agreement, he is seen as responsible for Israeli security rather than Palestinian security. So they see him more in the line of, General Lahad that sort of ran a little mini area of security for Israel. That basically Israel says, well, put those people in jail. Why don't you kill your own people? Why are you forcing us to kill them? And this is the way that he's being portrayed right now. So he's not very popular.
Hmm. Well, I indeed have other callers, so I probably should continue. We'll go next to a caller in Champaign. This will be line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a comment that I wanted to make regarding a subject that you just raised, actually, before the previous call, and that is the role of our government in this whole process. I think that the U.S. government has been for too long too partial and one-sided and going as far as possible and even further to defend the Israeli position and to justify whatever they do. I think some of the efforts made by our government to, so to speak, bring an end to this conflict could be easily interpreted as efforts that are intended to bring an end to this in the best interest of Israel and not a fair resolution. This is very unfortunate because unless and until there is a fair, an impartial mediator here we can't reach to any lasting peace in the area. Unfortunately, many of us Americans don't see this, but the rest of the world does. The rest of the world's view of American government has changed quite a bit because they see the atrocities that are committed, particularly by the Israeli government. I know that there's fighting going on both sides, but how can we not condemn these acts and still expect people to respect our position? And that's partially because of one comment that your guest, Dr. Haddad, made earlier, that there are too many pro-Israeli elements in the U.S. government policymaking, and also in the media. Your previous caller mentioned George Will as saying that there's a possibility that perhaps some people are pursuing the idea of killing Jews or Israelis. But, if you look at the numbers, it's the Israelis who are killing the Palestinians. Unfortunately, there is too much Jewish or Zionist, I should say, influence in the American media, and they are enforcing the positions and actions of Israeli government. And that's very unfortunate.
Well, Professor Haddad, would you like to?
Yeah, that would be the view shared by a lot of Arabs and Muslims in the United States, and it's shared by Arabs and Muslims overseas. I would say all the Muslim world. And, I've been looking at the slogans as they march, and it always says, no justice, no peace. And there's this feeling that the Palestinians are not getting any justice under the Oslo Agreement or the proposed peace solution. And therefore, they don't want this kind of peace because they see it as pacification. In fact, they're beginning to look at it as sort of like the American Indians, that the solution would be to put these Arabs into reservations, except that they're in worse condition because there are no land surrounding the cities. And basically what the Israelis are doing is confiscating the land and creating bypass roads, which are open only to Jews, and therefore dispossessing the Palestinians of their orchards and olive groves and so on and so forth.
Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I'll continue because I have a number of other people waiting. We'll go next to Savoy. This is line number 3. Hello.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask your caller if she could help us make sense of American attitudes toward the Middle East. It seems that the overwhelming majority of Christians in America, even people who are otherwise quite reasonable and sensitive to matters of justice and decent people, but when it comes to the Middle East, they are such extreme supporters of the Israeli Jews, even at the expense of the Palestinian Christians. Christians in America don't seem to even realize that there is a Christian community in Palestine or in Israel or in the occupied territories or in Israel proper, that they are just invisible to American Christians, and I can't understand why that is. Could you give us some...
I will try. I think that, if you look back historically, you'll find that, Christianity in the area was dominant until the coming of the Crusades. And although most Western textbooks talk about the Crusades as going to conquer Muslims, I mean, basically when the Crusades went, they destroyed all the Eastern Christian centers. They wiped out Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria, where you had the four major archbishoprics of Christianity, and they killed a lot of Christians. And what was wrong with them is they were the wrong kind of Christians. And, when they went into Jerusalem, the Crusades killed the Christians who were hiding in the church. They killed women, men, and children. It was sort of like genocide. And what you have is sort of a residue of that a lot of Americans, if I say I'm Christian, they always say, well, when didn't you convert? And sometimes, I say, well, since the time of Paul, because literally my mother was born in Antioch, my father in Tarsus, and people look at me and say, Paul who? Because they expect that the Middle East is all Muslim, and I think that's mostly ignorance, because a lot of Americans have their knowledge about the Middle East out of Sunday school textbooks, which never go beyond sort of the biblical times, and then they may jump into present-day Israel. I think there is also another issue, which is the evangelical Christian right, and it's estimated being about 40 million. I have no idea how big it is in the United States. But according to the theology of the Christian right, especially after it was reformulated after the 1967 war, in which Israel defeated all its Arab neighbors, they changed their theology. In fact, if you read Pat Robertson, he says the era of Christian power is at an end. It is the era of Jewish power. And he begins to talk about the theology of the end of time. In order to have the end of time, all the Jews will have to go back to Jerusalem, and then Jesus is going to come. First, they're going to build the temple. And so it's very important to destroy the Islamic mosque so that they can build a Jewish temple in order to fulfill Christian theology of the end of time. And in this case, Jesus is going to come, and then there's going to be a war in which the Muslims and the Jews will kill each other, and basically Judaism will be wiped out from the earth, because all of them will be killed except 144,000 who will survive, only because they accept Jesus Christ as Savior. And so what you have in this theology is the final solution of the Jewish problem. The thing that's interesting is when you talk to Jewish people, Israeli people, they know that is the ultimate and that the Christian right has in mind. However, out of political expediency, they collaborate. And you have, Israeli Prime Minister giving even a jet plane as a gift to one of the Christian evangelists and so on and so forth. And there's a great deal of collaboration between these two groups, and they have a great deal of support for the State of Israel because of this theological reinterpretation that took place in the 1970s.
So that's the Christian right. But what about the more mainstream churches? They also seem to be oblivious to the...
That's not true. I mean, if you look at the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, has come out with a statement which is in support of what they're talking about is the remnant Christian population in the area. They're talking about the de-Christianization of Jerusalem. According to statistics that they have, and I don't know how reliable they were, but prior to 1948, Jerusalem had 28,000 Christians. Today, there are less than 4,000. And this is being called, even in some of the, the people, the Christian, what we call mainline, but basically they're the ones who are sort of part of the National Council of Churches. They talk about it as the de-Christianization of Jerusalem. But they also a World Vision has gone in, which is more evangelical than the others. You have the Lutheran Church, the Mennonites, and the Quakers. And they all have come out with a statement. The Presbyterians have come out with a statement. Actually, we have a big dossier of where these mainline churches, and they have all come out and called for a more even-handed treatment of the Palestinian issue, but it did not make the press. And that's very interesting to me. The fact that the mainline churches have come out in support of the Palestinians rather than the Israelis in this case is on the Internet, but it is not in New York Times or Washington Post.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking this morning with Professor Ivan Haddad. She's professor of Christian-Muslim relations at the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. So we're Georgetown University, and we're talking about what has happened in Israel over the last month or so. Questions, welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's another Champaign person to talk with on line number one. Hello?
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. In the last 3 or 4 years, as a Jew, I've tried to talk to other Jews about the Israel issue in a critical way. I feel like I've become an expert on rationalization, denial, as well as the history of this area. Everything that people need to know is available, but not in the popular press. It isn't really a very controversial issue. It's very clear what's happened there, and it's very damaging to Jewish religious and secular life, to the moral integrity of Jewish religious and secular life in this country, that loyalty to Israel has become such an assumed thing, and that people have to spend so much of their time denying what's going on than acknowledging what the truth of it is. And I guess I'm just wondering if you have any comments on...
I really appreciate what you're saying, because I meet Jewish people who express the same sentiment. And, that's the Judaism I knew. I grew up in Aleppo, where our neighbors were Jews, and we always got together we were friends. I know everybody says that, but I really mean it in a very important way, because my father was a refugee from Turkey, and he came out with the Jewish population, and they were very, very strong friends. And so this tension is something that, you know, we all try and cope with, but it is a fact that there are people who are within the Jewish faith who are willing to stand up and say what you just said. That makes it a very tough thing, because it's tough because it's much easier for Muslims and Christians to say, well, they're all that way.
But
so I'm proud of the fact that you can say that.
Well,
I think it's important.
Yeah. I think it's becoming more common just in the last few weeks. I've been reading more on the Internet about activists in various places.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people are coming out of the... I think more Jews are coming out of the, you know, the closet, so to speak, because they, you know, if not now, when?
That's right.
But
I really appreciate it.
But one thing that I think might be helpful is, at least if Jews understood... You know, this is maybe a minor point, but whichever way you can begin to get other people to understand the plight of Arab Jews in you know, Iraq and Egypt and Syria and countries like that in the late 1940s and early 1950s, if people can just begin to understand what happened to these cultures under the pressure of Zionist Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can talk about that.
Well, I can, because what happened was that, you know, when Israel was formed, it had certain policies that were applied to its Christian and Muslim citizens. You know, they couldn't travel outside their little village without permission, even if they had to go to a doctor who wasn't available in the village. They had to go to the military police to get that. And so what happened is, in Syria and other places, they instituted the same rules on their Jewish population. When the Palestinians left or were pushed out, whichever term you prefer to use, basically Israel confiscated all the land and gave it to Israelis. And so when Jews left Iraq and Syria and Egypt, the land was given to other people. So there were reciprocal measures that were taken, and just as Arabs in Israel were considered as fifth column, Jews that were left in the Arab world were considered as fifth column. And one of the things that's interesting, which is rarely talked about, is that Israel wanted the Jews to move into Israel because it wanted a larger Jewish population, that it sent its own people to bomb the synagogue in Baghdad in order to scare the Jews of Iraq to emigrate to Israel. Most people don't talk about that, but it is part of history. It is documented in new Israeli revelations about how the state was put together. And I think that it is something that we have to keep in mind, because Arabs know this history, and this is why they are always asking for justice, and they feel that the American press distorts the reality, and they want the history to, you know, they want people to say, yes, it was wrong that these people were kicked out because they belonged to a different faith, and so it is, you know, a tragedy in a sense, because when the Muslims and the Jews were kicked out of Spain, it was the Muslims who took the Jews in. They were brought into the Ottoman Empire, welcomed, and put in charge of the economy. They went into North Africa and lived there. And even the former king of Morocco, the late king, he called himself king of the Jews because they were living in harmony and shared the same experience of the Inquisition in Spain. So it is a very unfortunate situation.
We just have a couple of minutes left, time for perhaps one, maybe two more callers. We'll do what we can. Going to the campus next, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I'll make this quick. I just thought it was kind of telling when David Horowitz was on, and he was addressing the fact that so many Palestinians have died recently compared to the number of Israeli. He kept saying, well, would it do any good if an equal number of Israelis died? But the fact is that at that very point when it was just rocks coming from the Palestinians, the Israelis made that answered that question resoundingly yes, that it would be better if now that the rocks are coming over, if a lot of Palestinians died. You know, he was so arrogant he couldn't even see the illogic of his position. I just wanted to ask you quickly, can you verify, I'm trying to find out what the veracity of some of the stuff on the internet is. Is it true that a Palestinian was set afire and killed that way, you know, burned alive by Israeli settlers? Do you happen to know?
Yeah. Oh, this is not recent, right? Or is this the recent one in Hebron?
That I'm not sure.
Right, but you know, as a result of the lynching of the two undercover Israeli soldiers that were killed in Ramallah, there is on the internet actually a list, and it is verifiable that the Israeli army has lynched, you know, quite a few Palestinians, and there is no question about it. It's part of the history. The thing is that most people don't realize, you know, people talk about Arafat as a terrorist, and he probably is. I mean, I don't know what he's done, but, you know, he's not a very nice person. But so neither is Barak. I mean, people forget that Barak dressed as a woman, and he's an assassin. He went into Lebanon and killed, actually, somebody who was an Episcopalian poet. And he didn't like his poetry because he was the national voice of the Palestinians. He assassinated him. I mean, that is a terrorist, too, but we never see it that way. And you never hear anybody question the fact because he was wearing a military uniform. So that the Arabs and the Palestinians see a great deal of discrepancy between what is acceptable. I mean, there seems to be a great deal of tolerance in the American press for the killing of Palestinians. And it's very interesting, you know, when this program was introduced, it was about the events in Israel. The Palestinians see it as Israel and occupied territory. And the thing that is interesting is most of the killing has been in the occupied territory. And there were nine Arab Israelis that were killed, in the Nazareth incident. But basically, it is Palestinian kids who are saying, get the occupation forces out. The thing is that Israel has made a decision. It doesn't want these Palestinians because they are Christian and Muslim, and they would dilute a Jewish state. But it also doesn't want them to have enough of a land in order for them to have a state. And this is what they're fighting for. They need the land. They need to be considered as a people. They need an identity card. They need some kind of recognition that they have suffered.
I'm going to have to jump in at this point simply because we have used the time for this hour. And my apologies, we have some callers can't take, but I'm sure we'll continue to talk about this on other programs. And we also want to say to you, Professor Haddad, thank you very much for talking
with us. You're most
welcome. Our guest, Ivan Haddad, is a professor of Christian-Muslim relations at Georgetown University.